It's a Friday, March 12th, and we're doing a Chumash in the morning. Perhaps we'll take up some issues pertaining to Parshat HaChodesh, which is read this Shabbos. And it's in Parshas Bo, Perek Yud Beis. And it seems to initiate the final phase in the Geula, the redemption from Mitzrayim. It's after the nine plagues have taken place. And it seems, to all intents and purposes, that that part of it, the quote-unquote, the ball game, so to speak, I mean in the sense of the whole, I mean it's serious, I'm just using the word, with Paro, that phase, the negotiation, so to speak, with Paro. It's a very, very important point, Agavurcha, that, well, let me pose this question to you. Many people raise the question with regard to the fact that all along the Jews were only making a very, very modest demand from Paro. That's something that people tend to overlook. And everybody has the idea, the basic idea seems to be, that Moshe demanded that Paro free the Jews, let my people go, that type of thing. I think most people have that sense that when Moshe went to Paro, he was demanding freedom. And that Moshe was the great fighter for freedom. But if you look at it very carefully, it's not the case. It doesn't even come up. Moshe never spoke to Paro about that. He never mentioned freedom from slavery. All he was asking for was an opportunity to serve Hashem. And Shalach Ami v'yavduni v'yachogu li, send forth my nation, and they will have a chag dedicated to Hashem in the Midbar. And that's all. And then, of course, they'll come back. He wasn't saying they wouldn't come back. That's all Moshe was asking for. In that framework, it becomes very, very amazing that Paro was so stubborn and refused, adamantly refused. Given that that's the case, I mean, there's many questions that you could ask. For example, what if Paro would have said yes? What if Paro would have agreed? What would have happened then? Would the Jews have been obligated to keep their end of the agreement, and that is to come back? And what would have happened? I thought that the whole point was that the Jews should be free, and that they should leave Mitzrayim and go to Eretz Canaan, become a whole new nation. If that's the case, so then was it a deception? Were they employing deception then, knowing full well that once Paro gave them permission, they wouldn't come back? Now, some people have raised questions about that, because it does seem, if you look at it superficially, that there's something missing. There is an element, perhaps, of deception, because, as I said, according to the original demand, the demand for Paro from Hashem was that he let the Jews go for 3 days. A distance of 3 days' journey, and then they'll come back. Although that itself is not discussed. That is, the issue of coming back is not openly discussed. Nobody talks about that. But it seems pretty obvious that that was the point, and that at one point Paro is willing to give in. I mean, that's his struggle under the increasing pressure of the Makos. So Paro starts to weaken, and at certain points he's prepared to give in, but then he always finds some reason to pull back. But at one point he offers them to let them have the Chag in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, and then Moshe says that we can't do that. The reason he gives is that the Egyptians will attack us, because they deified the sheep. So it's just not possible to do it in Mitzrayim. Now, when the Jews did leave in Bishalach, so they just leave, and of course the objective of God is to cause Paro to be confused and to chase after them, but clearly they had no intention of returning. So the question is, was deception involved? Now you could say it, but the Jews had a right to use deception. And that is because when you're in a situation, when you're in prison unjustly, when someone is treating you unjustly, you have a right to do whatever you can to save yourself, to free yourself. So I'm not saying that they owed Paro the truth. That's not the point. That is, even if that's the conclusion, that they employed deception and they lied to Paro, and as a result of that they obtained their freedom, I don't see what the problem is with that. I'm not saying that I agree with the question. The only thing I would ask on that, well, let me put it to you. How do you understand that phenomenon? That is, that the Jews, in point of fact, never returned to Paro. The implication was that they would, that they were only objecting to the prohibition, or the fact that they couldn't serve God, and that they wanted the opportunity to serve God. However, when Paro did send them, they never came back. So how do you understand that? Was that a use of the art of deception? But it's justified. That's an important point to realize, that we don't look at it that way, that in every situation a person is obligated to tell the truth at any cost, even in a situation where he's being subjected to evil. But still, in all, I'm asking you if that's the way you understand it. So the question is, why didn't the Moshe bring it out in the open? See, even if you justify it and say that Paro had no right to enslave them, obviously, if you're, you know, in the Holocaust or any other situation of persecution, you do whatever you can to get out of there and save your life. So if you can concoct a lie and they'll believe it, so it's perfectly moral. To the contrary, it would be immoral not to save yourself, because what they're doing is evil. You're a victim of evil. Now, you could say that that would justify them lying over here, but my question would be, well, why would that be necessary? Why didn't they confront Paro on a different level? All right, so I'm raising that as the question. Well, why from day one didn't Moshe make it clear that what you're doing is evil, and we want, God demands that you free this people, and then so on and so forth? By the way, along the lines, another question is very interesting. And that is that, superficially speaking, one can make the case that Moshe was not a great negotiator. Because, for example, in the case of the Tzfardea, and as the Makos get harder, Paro seems to cave in. And he pleads with Moshe to remove the plague, and then he'll send the Jews out. Take a look at chapter Zion, Shemos. And Moshe comes to Paro and he warns him, and that if he does not let them go, he's going to smite all of the boundaries with Sephardim, and so on and so forth. And then he does so, and the Sephardim come forth. Then it's interesting. It says that the Vayasukein hachartumim belotehem, that the magicians were able to duplicate. Well, it's not real duplication. That's an impossibility. But whatever it was they did with their arts to make it appear that they were capable of doing the same thing on some level, even though the magnitude was not the same. And then it says that Paro. Vayikra Paro l'Moshe l'Aaron, that Paro called to Moshe and Aaron, and he said to entreat Hashem and to remove the Tzfardim from me and my nation, Vashalcha Asa'am, and I'll send forth the nation, V'yizchu Lashem, and they'll serve God. Now that's clear that that's what Paro was saying. He had no intention of freeing them. He just said he'll send them forth to sacrifice to God. But he didn't say that they're free. Then Vayomer Moshe l'Paro hispoer alai. So Moshe said to Paro to, you know, glorify yourself, so to speak. In other words, whatever you pick, whatever, anytime you want. Moshe didn't want to pick the time. That's, yeah, we could see that on any level. Had Moshe picked the time, it would not have been effective, because then Paro was wavering over here. Paro was not convinced that this was from Hashem. And he didn't have that concept in his mind. But rather, he was very suspicious that Moshe was obviously a brilliant person, and he knew certain things that they didn't know. Whether it's about these arts of sorcery or how the system works. And that's what Paro was concerned about, that Moshe had this knack, he knew how to bring this about, and he knew when it would terminate. So if Moshe would have told him the time, then it wouldn't have had the proper effect. Because he would say that, Moshe has this knowledge that we don't have. That's why Moshe let him pick the time. I mean, it's kind of like in Lahavdil, whatever, you know, a magician who's very good. So he lets you pick the cards and he turns around. Instead of him picking a card out of the deck and giving it to you, not looking at it and giving it to you. Okay, so that's impressive, but you figure he picked the card, he knew where it was. So in order to make it more impressive, the magician will give you the deck of cards. He says, pick any card, he'll turn around, pick any card you want. And whatever the shtick is, but that's more impressive to people. What is strange, though, is that Moshe goes ahead, because he says L'machar, and the Mefarshim point out that why did he say L'machar? If he was in such pain, usually when a person is suffering in such pain, he can't take it anymore, he wants immediate relief. So why did Paro say L'machar and endure the pain until tomorrow? So the Mefarshim, I think it's the Ibn Ezra, but I'm not sure anymore which one. That's the point, he says, is because he was waiting that this will terminate of its own accord, just that Moshe, you know, knows something that we don't know, but it'll terminate. Maybe it'll terminate, and I won't have to give in to anything. So he was willing to endure the pain even longer. And then Moshe agrees, and Laman teda ki ein kashem elokeinu, in order that you should know that there is nothing out there comparable to Hashem, and that the Sephardim will be removed completely. Rak by Or Tisha Arna. He spells out specifically. Then it says that Moshe and Aaron went from before Paro, and Moshe cried out to Hashem with regard to the Sephardim. And then it says Vayas Hashem Kidvar Moshe, and Hashem acted in accordance with the Dvar Moshe, and the Sephardim died out. And then it says that they had to create these tremendous heaps, and the land began to stink. But then it says, "Vayar Paro ki hoyso harvacha." That Paro saw that there was a respite. Vahach beiras libo, and he hardened his heart. So you see, it's an unbelievable depiction of the Russia. That is, that he can't form a firm conviction and stick to it. But his evil emotions keep coming back to the fore. That is, under the stress of the pain, so it subdues his evil emotions. But he never goes further than that. He should have gone further than that. This was an opportunity. Nevertheless, as soon as the situation improves, the evil emotions bounce right back in, and he's in a state of denial again. Velo shama aleihem kasha dibra Hashem. But let me ask you a question. Was Moshe a good negotiator?
Moshe should have.
It seems contrary, it's counterintuitive, anybody knows when you got the guy where you want him, so to speak, and you hold the power and you hold the leverage, and he says, okay, I'll give you the, let's say it's a kidnapper, and he'll give you the child or whatever it is. You don't go ahead and pay him, and then he's got the money, he can do whatever he wants. You always work it out that way. Of course, both sides are a little bit concerned. At this point in time, Paro's not making any conditions. He just wants to get rid of the frogs. But so you say, okay, fine, let him go first. Or you work it out, because then Paro could say, well, how do I know that you'll get rid? So you work it out in a way that as you start to let them go, the situation will slowly get, you know, it'll be less and less, it'll be diminished. So that's goodwill gestures, whatever the case is. Now, this happens, this is not the first time this happens, by the way. This is a pattern. If you go further, you see the same thing happening again by the Arov, that Paro finally agrees to let them go. Yeah, this is in Perek Ches. Kafhe vayomos hinei nochi yotem imach vatarti el Hashem v'sorhe orov miparo umeyavadov mayamo machar rak al Yosef paro haseh levilti shalach hazam lizboach l'Hashem. So Moshe, in this case, after the negotiation, tells him that I'm going to entreat God to remove the orov, and then he's sort of like, emphasizing with him. But Paro should be serious. Don't play around. Once I do this, you should send forth the nation. But why didn't he learn the lesson? I'm just asking. I'm not being disrespectful of Moshe. I'm just for emphasis here. Even the first time, he should have not given Paro what he wanted until Paro gave something. He's learned the lesson. So why didn't he do this? This time he's doing the same thing, and he's saying, "But you know, don't kid around with us anymore. Be serious. Keep your word." Well, I wouldn't have said that. I would say, you failed the test. I shouldn't have trusted you the first time. Now I'm not going to do anything until you let them go. And you want to keep suffering with the Arav? Go right ahead. This is not the only time, though. The same thing happens time and again. Whenever Paro agrees, Moshe automatically removes, prays to God. Obviously, Moshe is not the power over here, but he prays to God. And Hashem listens to him. Well, I guess one can ask the question of Hashem also. Why didn't Hashem tell Moshe that you're going about it the wrong way? You want to get them out of there, just let them suffer. Because the only reason why he's agreeing is because of the pain of the moment. Yeah, another good question, of course, is that why does it work this way, that the Makos at first are very mild? And in fact, the first time that Moshe goes to Paro, there's no maka at all. There's no demonstration. There's just words. Shalach Adami. And Paro refuses, and then Paro, in fact, even increases their labors. Then, the second instance, there's no maka, but the demonstration with the snake. And he takes the staff and turns it into a snake. And then, even then, one could ask, that the magicians duplicate it. All right, so then it says that Moshe's staff, well, Moshe's snake ate their snakes. Okay, fine, but still in all, one would think that there's something lacking in the demonstration. Why didn't Hashem provide Moshe with a miracle that was irrefutable? So even if you say that Moshe's was better than theirs, but already, once they can duplicate it, it sort of weakens the whole thing, the impression. Any magician, if he's successful, he's going to wow the audience. And he's going to do something which people there cannot do. But if there are people there that can basically do it, it's just that he does it a little bit better, that's not going to have the same effect. All right, so he's a little bit more polished than we are. Yet, that's not the case. Then the next one is the blood, the waters turn to blood. And even that is not so devastating. Paro is able to escape the effects, because it says that they dug around. They dug around the Nile, so they had to exert themselves in order to get water. But it says that Paro didn't faze him. He had his magicians do the same thing. And then the next one, that's Tsvardeya, is hard for him. He can't escape that one. And that gets him. But they get successively stronger and stronger. So why do you have to go through all these steps? Why not go right to the main blow? Give him something that's going to knock him, you know, into submission. It's a good point being made that the Makos were not indiscriminate. For example, the first three have to do with the land, specifically the Nile. And there's a reason for that. The Nile turns into blood. Because the Nile was something which they sort of deified. They deified themselves. They viewed themselves as being special people. Where that's what gave them all this arrogance. And it had to do with the Nile. They viewed this as being divine. And they themselves partook of this. So in attacking the Nile, there was a breakdown of their own self-deification, the deification. That's the way it is. People feel unique and special and different, superior, chosen by nature, so to speak. And they've been surrounded by these entities which are superior. The worship of the Nile, when they worship the Nile, they mean that this Nile has a certain type of a divine-like quality which relates to us because we're special, and it has a certain permanence. That is, they don't have to be concerned about anything else because this Nile is theirs and it's always going to be providing that for them. So the Nile itself turns against them. That's a tremendous blow. That's a very good point. There's no question about that. But that's a secondary phenomenon. I think that's secondary. The primary thing was to attack Paro, to put the pressure on Paro. In the case of the dam and the hitting of the Nile, from a purely abstract point, I think Mark is making a good point. From a purely abstract point, it should have broken him down, because it wasn't just a physical pain. Rather, it was a tremendous blow to his whole understanding of his position in the world, the deification of the Nile. But he wasn't on that level to take it to heart. However, from the purely personal pain, he was able to avoid it. The Pasuk says, Vayifen Paro, Vayelech el Beso. He turned aside, he went to his house. Well, why does it have to tell you that he went to his house? Why do I care where he went? It's not. It's conveying the point that he went to escape the reality. The Russia escapes from the reality. He was able to escape from it. So, like a lot of times, a person doesn't want to confront certain things, but he needs to escape. So, I don't know. He goes to his house and he puts on the TV and he gets absorbed in a different world. He's able to push reality aside. Man has the capability of escaping reality or avoiding reality. The uniqueness of the second one, which is very interesting because it says that the magicians were able to duplicate it, even the second one. But that wasn't enough. This time Paro gave in because he couldn't find an escape. Because this attacked him just like it attacked everybody else. It was in his house, in his ovens, in his servants. So he couldn't escape. Since he couldn't escape it, he had no choice. And because of that pressure, he gave in. Our question is, Moshe did not seem to take full advantage of the opportunity that was presented. Because he should have said, I will not remove them until you make some moves to free the Jews. And then I'll do it, or then I'll do it gradually. But Moshe didn't use that tactic. In order to answer these questions, what we really have to go back to, and this is a good point in terms of methodology, what was the objective of the negotiations, the shlichus of Moshe to Paro? What was the objective? If you say that the objective was to free the Jews, So then all of our questions are very good. Indeed, why would you even need 10? You can give him one maka that would really knock the resistance out of him. So that can't be the case. But the real objective was that Paro should recognize Hashem. Paro and Mitzrayim and his servants, they should recognize Hashem and release the Jews because they recognize Hashem of their own free will. It was all about free will. And that's why when Moshe first went to Paro, there were no makos. It was just communication, ideas. He taught him about Hashem. Hashem rules the universe. And it's his will that the people should have the opportunity to serve him. Paro refused. And then progressively, in other words, Hashem is dealing with Paro on his level. The highest level would have been by virtue of using the mind, the ideas. But then he needs the demonstration. And finally he needs the makos. The purpose of the makos is to teach. It's a teaching mechanism. So that he can't escape from the reality. But Moshe would not demand that he first let the Jews go. Because that wouldn't be a free will. That wouldn't be recognition. That would mean that the pain... Free will is, you twist a person's arm, that's not free will. So what was the idea of the maka? The problem with Paro, of course, was that he had the evil inclination, his yetzer hara. And under the pain of the maka, it subdued the yetzer hara. Then when the maka was gone, as we said, the yetzer hara returned. The purpose then was that Moshe wanted to remove the maka and see how Paro would act after it's been removed. An intelligent person, if he gets an illness, and the illness is because of his reckless behaviors and so forth, but he denies the reality. Then he suffers. So when he's suffering, he regrets, why did I do this? I was so stupid. But what happens after the illness goes away? So very often, that depends. If he's a chacham, so then he learns the lesson, and he removes the bad emotions because of that idea, and he embarks on a new course. But if he's a fool, so then while he's under the pain, then he talks sensibly. But he doesn't go any further to uproot the underlying problem, and as soon as the pain is gone, he reverts back to his old behaviors. That was the whole idea. That Paro and his servants were given the opportunity. And you see, all along, that's really, there's many further indications. But Moshe says, I know that you haven't begun to fear God yet, and so on and so forth. There's many indications of this point. I can't go through all the particulars right now. But that's why, in my opinion, he only made a modest request. And if you ask, the modest request was that we're just asking to serve Hashem. And you'll say, but let's say Paro would have given in and would have let them go. So then they would have apparently been under the obligation to return. Because they made an agreement. In my opinion, the answer is that, and I believe the Rav said this one time, that if you understand it superficially, it's a problem, but if Paro goes through the transformation, he uproots his Yetzara, and he recognizes Hashem, and he lets them go, so this will just be the beginning. So then, of course, he wouldn't... then Moshe would teach him more about the evils of enslavement, and so on and so forth. Then Paro himself would become an Eved Hashem. And there wouldn't be any need for the Makas Bechoros and all of that. It's only after all of these attempts have failed, there's a termination point. A person doesn't have an infinite amount of time to just work on himself. Finally, after the ninth maka, when he kicks Moshe out, don't see me anymore. Then Hashem brings down the Makas Bechoros. Makas Bechoros was a different phenomenon. That was done to force Paro to let them go. It was not a free will decision. Paro gets up in the middle of the night, he comes running from... He no longer is operating with free will. Paro has simply become a tool. And thus, the Jews were not obligated to return at that point, because the obligation to return was based upon the negotiations. The negotiations were over. That was it. No more deals on the table. Now, a different reality sets in. Paro is overwhelmed with a makkah that he simply can't abide, and he kicks them out, he drives them out. And there was no negotiation, there was no agreement. He throws them out, and the Jews had no obligation to return at all.